Welcome to QuakeCast, the podcast for id Software's classic Quake and the games it inspired.
Hello? Anyone? Hello?
Hey, I hear a familiar voice. I haven't heard you in so long. Who are you?
Well, I've been off saving the world from an asteroid.
That's right. Thank
you. It is BRC. I am back.
We really appreciate that.
Yeah, it turns out I went out to space to blow it up, but it wasn't actually there. I think someone sent me out on a wild goose chase. I suspect JCR so he could host again.
Correct. Yep. It's all a ruse.
Welcome to the QuakeCast, everybody. It's good to be back. Today, we are talking to a professional commentator in the Quake scene, Jahar.
Yeah, Jahar has been a fixture in online communities for multiplayer for Doomworld and Quake and Quake Champions, Quake 2, also mapping as well. So he's been around for a while, and you may have heard his casting on some of these high-profile matches at QuakeCon over the years.
You're also going to hear about the very unique way he decided to propose to his wife, and it involves Quake, believe it or not. So guys, stay tuned. You're going to want to hear this.
So romantic.
Ooh, yeah, baby. Jibs, baby, jibs.
Actually, it's a little bit of a weird thing. It really was Doom first and for a long time, because I was a voracious pirater of SNES ROMs and NES ROMs. That's mostly what my PC gaming was for a while, was just playing NES and SNES things. And I got the ROM for Doom and was remarking at how crap it was. Like, no textures on the floors, no textures on the ceilings. It was dark, and I think I got to like E2, M2 before I was like, this is just unplayable. So yeah, I made it through like an entire first episode of Doom on an SNES emulator on a PC, and then I realized how stupid I was being. I was younger. I haven't gotten that much smarter since, if I'm perfectly honest. And then, yeah, I grabbed Doom 95 at that point, which was, you know, the main Windows port before any of... It was, like, one of the first real, like, source ports, right? So, and then I discovered the marvelous world of PWADs, and that was it for me. Like, that was it. Like, as soon as I realized, like, there was, you know, an endless supply of content to play, that's all I needed to just know what that was my game for life. And then getting on Doom World, getting... appropriately abused there by all the older gentry, which is, you know, exactly what you should expect, and it's positive reinforcement, and it's been that way for forever. And I only really started branching out into Quake around 06 or so, when at the time Doom mapping was much more about cramming as many sectors in there as possible, using as many 3D floors as possible. And you can do 3D floors in Doom. It's just more of a pain in the ass. And it's like, if you guys want to do maps that look more like Quake, I'm just going to go do Quake maps instead. I haven't done mapping in a very long time. I would like to get back into it. And of course, now is a perfect time with Trench Room being what it is and making life just so much easier. And it's got a lot of people in there. But for me, it was a little bit of mapping in Quake 2. And then that got more into the competitive side of it, and then that got into broadcasting and so on and so forth.
So now, were you always involved in the multiplayer scene? Was that just basically it, or did you kind of split your time between single player and multiplayer? In other words, was Quake your first foray into like serious multiplayer, or had you been doing that with Doom?
Well, the neat thing about doing multiplayer maps is you get to watch people play them in real time. Which of course, you know, now you get to do a bit more with single player maps. At the time, like, streaming wasn't as big of a thing, but making a multiplayer map and then getting like, you know, 12 people into it and everybody fragging each other, I mean, that's just neat, and that's always been neat to me. So I took advantage of that and did a few things for Quake 2, did a few things for Doom prior to that. But I haven't been mapping in a very long time, and I would like to get back into it. But the broadcast side of it kind of took over everything, and that's where all my time's been.
Yeah, so I was going to ask, since you got into Quake in 2006, and seems like you had sort of a short foray with that until you got into broadcasting and shoutcasting and stuff like that. So how did that come about?
Well, Quake 2, and I got into Quake 2 because at the time, like, nobody was really playing custom Quake World maps, and nobody was really playing custom Quake 3 maps outside of the previously established, you know, popular things. But the Tasteless Playing Quake 2 community had a default port server with nothing but hundreds and hundreds of custom maps. And it was an open enough community that if you made a map and you got it on the server, you know, you could just bring it into the rotation and get some, like, real people in it. So that was appealing to me. But that same community, the same guy who runs TasteySplain.net Quads, he also provided server space on his box, because I think his logic was, I have this this colo box for the Quake servers. They don't take up that much space, even with, like, all the gigs of Quake 2 content on there. So I might as well just, like, give community members server space. And that was, like, a really neat thing for him to do. And so I started poking around, and it was a Linux server. So I was like, oh, I can run, like, a Shoutcast server on it. And of course, at the time, you know, DJ Wheat was doing a lot of, you know, Radio ITG stuff and doing a lot of, like, QTV games for Quake 3. And that was just, like, the coolest thing. And I thought, hey, maybe I could do something like that. And that started with a Shoutcast server way before video, way before that was anything near accessible to a consumer level. And of course, things have gotten so much better since then. And oh, now yeah, everybody's doing it.
Yeah, I think that's quite literal. Everybody's doing it. I think I saw somebody's mom playing Fortnite or something the other day. So
yeah,
it's pretty nuts.
Yeah, it's opened a lot of doors. And one of the neatest things is seeing, you know, what are generally reclusive people, you know, Quake and Doom mappers, starting to do more live streams of their, you know, mapping process and their flow. And that's great, because it goes from being inside of a deep, dark cave, you know, where everybody's a hermit and comes out with their magical wonders, to being something that, you know, you can watch in real time and get people excited about, you know, downloading Trench Broom.
You brought that up earlier, and it just dawned on me. I'm like, yeah, that's right. You know, not many people would have experienced a single player map if they were just strictly involved in multiplayer, because and RC and I've talked about this before, for many years I was just playing multiplayer. I played casually, and I played on LANs mostly, because I'm pretty terrible. So I had to invite my friends over who are all noobs and then beat them up. But yeah, that is a really interesting part, a new dynamic where so many more people are seeing single player stuff now than ever before. That's a good observation.
Yeah, there have been a few high profile projects that have, you know, made the rounds in media and gotten people interested. And even if there are some, like, Doom mods or Quake mods that aren't necessarily my cup of tea, they're getting a lot more people into the games, which is neat. And the fact that, well, one of the things with TSTV, the idea was always to kind of bridge the gaps between the communities. You know, we know that there's a few hundred people playing Quake World, there's a few hundred people playing Quake 2, a few hundred people playing Quake Live. Having one place where all that content could be found was kind of an appealing prospect to me, especially since the demise of Planet Quake. So when that went away, you know, the individual communities stopped really communicating with each other, and I didn't want to see that happen. But there was another gap, which was just the one between multiplayer and single player. And that gap over the years has been much harder to bridge than the gap between, like, Quake World players and Quake 2 players.
Yeah, we've had experience with that. But yeah, I mean, hey, all this new technology, like Discord and all that stuff, it seems like things are going so quickly now and changing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I made a comment the other day where two of these really legendary mappers in our community were joined a server, a multiplayer server, and we're playing together. And like, oh, okay, these are good times now. Now we have these people who are so hardcore in a single player jumping on a server. It's pretty encouraging. So I think there'll just be more and more of that. I think that, you know, eventually there's going to be a Quake 1.5 update with significant multiplayer additions. I don't know when that's going to come out, but I have a feeling, because that mod did so well, we're going to see maybe some kind of resurgence in multiplayer on that in that area. I don't know, at least for that mod anyhow.
So, that would be really interesting, because I think the biggest or most difficult gap of them all is going to be NetQuake to QuakeWorld. That's just cats and dogs. I think that's an eternal struggle between those two groups of players.
And yeah, I always wondered why that was, and now I know. I really do, because it really has to do with you know, the progs and the differences and the things like that. Things you cannot do in Quake World, things you cannot do in NetQuake, and just melding those together is super tough. So there's a technological aspect to it as well. So
yeah, and it's something I don't know how many people are going to be listening who are aware of the multitude of differences there. But the long story short is Quake World came out as essentially a glorified patch for Quake. Which enabled much better play over modems at the time. And actually, a lot of those kind of heuristics and methods for dealing with latency are still in use today. So it was really a technological feat. But some of those changes drastically changed how the game was played in very non-trivial ways. And there are still holdouts for one reason or another who think that NetQuake is still, or a Quake before Quake World, which is ironically called NetQuake, is the way to go.
Let's move on to how you got into the kind of the more professional commentating, you know, because play-by-play, because I watched a few of your play-by-plays. In fact, the 2012 one, I watched all the way through last night, and I was just like literally on the edge of my seat. And you know, I'm like, God, this happened 7 years ago. And it what a great, it was a great match. So, so I have so much respect for commentators because my brain does not work that quickly. And, but yeah, you guys made it, you added so much to that match. If I was just watching an MOS kind of version of it with just the players, it just, you guys bring so much excitement to it. So how did you get involved with the kind of more serious kind of commentating stuff?
I'm trying to decide at what point it became serious. And I'm not sure if that point's been crossed for me.
I was going to say, maybe it hasn't become serious.
Because at that time, and this still is true in many ways, like Quake was not the big esport on the planet anymore. And I don't expect that to ever really happen again. And that's not me being cynical. That's just, you know, the way that the market goes. But I've always been kind of comfortable with that idea, maybe more comfortable than some others have been. But when I kind of made it in, things were kind of on a downhill slope as far as like general popularity goes. But that doesn't matter too much when the people who are involved are as passionate as they are and as passionate as they always will be. Like I mentioned, Quake World, like everybody who's competing in Quake World is 40 plus years old with, you know, families and real jobs, and they still make time to, you know, do LAN parties and be competitive. So doing, you know, coverage for events like that will always be appealing to me. And of course, QuakeCon is always kind of like the focal point of a lot of that competition. I was always interested in commentary. I always thought it was like fun and cool and neat. And even like Quake 2 mods like Q-Pong had like canned commentary as part of like the event system. And I thought that was just like the coolest thing ever.
That's right. I remember that. That was cool.
And so, yeah, there was always just some like just intrinsic appeal to that. And of course, like on the production side, you know, there's a lot of bells and whistles and a lot of buttons to push, and that's always been fun. And I've always kind of split my time between wanting to do more commentary and wanting to do more directing in that way. And I think for a lot of commentators, you know, they still want to see Quake, you know, succeed and do well. I'm still, you know, squeezing all the fun out of it I can, which is still quite a bit. And, yeah, we'll see how long that goes. But I think, you know, as long as Quake World players are around and Quake 2 players are around, there's always going to be things to do.
Definitely. With all the Quake stuff that you've been commentating over, have you ever felt the need or wanted to commentate over any other games, other communities you ever wanted to be a part of?
I've made no secret of the fact that I'm not a big Counter-Strike fan. There's a lot. I like tactical shooters as a genre. I just don't think Counter-Strike happens to be a very good one. And it's unfortunate because, you know, obviously there would be work to do if I enjoyed Counter-Strike at all. But I've also discovered I can't act like I can enjoy it.
That's a good point. You have to. That's a really good point. You can't fake it. I mean,
yeah. And I wouldn't want to be in that world anyway. And nobody would want me in that world. So it's better for everybody. Now, there have been a few games that have come and gone, but the nature of competitive gaming and esports has been it's been more fragile, ironically enough, over the years. You know, you've got games that will kind of come and go, and a game will show up that I kind of get excited about, and then, you know, something happens, like, you know, the lack of a spectator mode or lack of competitive features, and the game kind of fizzles away. And I've never really chased one hard enough to really you know, like, leave Quake, and I'm not sure I would ever want to. If there was ever a thing where it meant, like, not doing Quake events instead, then yeah, I don't think I would want to do that.
Oh yeah, I would never suggest as such. I was just curious if there was another game that you're like, oh, that would be fun.
I mean, there were things over the years. I mean, we had Brink TV from the Quake Live TV crowd, and we had a pre-launch event and a launch event, and then that was the end of that.
And yeah, then came and went, right?
It went much more than it came. Yeah.
Oh man.
And then Dirty Bomb had a little bit of a longer life, but ultimately it never really went very hard into kind of an esports arena thing. And unfortunately, in this market, like, it's way different than it was in the early 2000s, where, you know, the games were selected by competitive organizations based on, you know, what was being played. So all you needed to make something a successful esport was some baseline of popularity. And now it's the other way around. It's like, if unless you are a large publisher who is putting millions of dollars into the esports and really marketing budget, it's the same thing now. Then it's just not going to take off. You know, unless you're like Valve doing something as a first party, unless you're Blizzard doing something as a first party, Riot, it's a much more difficult, much more. it's a very complex thing to get into now, and there's like economies of scale that play into it. So if it means being content with, you know, the few hundred players playing this game or that game, then sure.
Right. Now, have you seen, I'm sure you've got experience taking a look at the Overwatch League and all that. Is there anything, or let me get your take on that, because we live near the arena, and so we've been a few times, and my kids did play Overwatch for a while, so I took them to one of the finals, and it was cool. It was really cool. It was like looking back and like looking at where we've arrived at, you know, ESL and all, and the way streams work and broadcasting, because everybody wanted to be on TV at one point. Now it doesn't matter,
right?
You know? And so when you see where it's gone in the higher tier, is there anything that you'd like to, you know, that any regrets you have or anything you're like, oh, that's really smart. You know, what are your observations on where it's gone?
I don't know if I have too many regrets. I'm not sure things could have panned out any other way than the way that they have been. Like, as soon as, I mean, I guess Blizzard really started it all, but it kind of hit scale with Riot when they started running events themselves. And as soon as one company got big enough to do esports entirely under their own purview, there was no going back from that. And I think if it wasn't Riot, it would have been Valve, it would have been Blizzard, it would have been somebody else. And over the course of the next, you know, couple of years, once that really started hitting, all of the third party circuits really started just dropping off the face of the planet, or third party circuits became second party circuits and working really closely with the publishers. So I don't know if there's a universe where that wouldn't have happened. And you mentioned Overwatch, and again, it's not really my cup of tea, but hey, people were playing some kind of shooter at least, and they're probably playing other shooters now. And I think that was, you know, some indication of, you know, there weren't people who were wanting to play this game for longer than you needed for a long-term esport. And I think that's really more of a function of the way games are marketed and the way they're consumed these days. You know, it's not, hey, I found this game that I really like, so I'm going to play it for the next 15 years. It's, hey, I found this game that I really like, and I'm going to play it as long as my friends are playing it. And because it's such a social thing, as soon as one friend or one small group of friends starts playing something else, then you drop whatever you're playing, you go play the new thing, and that's a ball that just keeps on rolling. And I don't want to sound too like cynical or downtrodden about that. I just don't see it happening any other way. It's just the way people work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I remember before we called them LAN parties, we used to call them Quake parties, and there was Quake, and that was it, basically. I mean,
at most LAN parties, you're not even really playing LAN games. You're still on Steam. Right. You're still on.
Yeah, you're connected. Yeah. And also, with my LAN parties, I had to limit it during the early days to just two or three games. And I just tell people, no, we're not going to jump around. Let's get a feel for some of these games that we spent $50 on back then. And, but I watch my kids have LAN parties and they play like five or six, seven different games and they're still having a blast. It's funny how things have changed so dramatically in just 20 years. It's nuts.
Yeah. And I guess if there's one thing you really want to preserve, it's the way those LAN parties felt. Clan A2M throws LAN parties from time to time. And yeah, their MO is, all right, everybody in the room get on this server. We're playing this for the next 2 hours. You don't get to say no. And it's strong arming it, but it works. And it's always a lot of fun.
Or if they say no, they get duct taped to some kind of ceiling apparatus, right?
Exactly.
Wedgies, all that.
I don't know. We're all older now. You don't want to wedgie some of these guys. You might get more than you bargained for.
Just spill the Metamucil on him.
Yeah. So you were talking about sort of like the marketing behind games nowadays, and it almost seems like companies are thinking about esports before they're even thinking about the game. I've seen the marketing for certain games with trailers or press releases where they're saying like, yes, this game is, you know, they're creating it to be the next big esport. But I don't think that people really graft onto games, you know, when they read that kind of press speak, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think that is what dictates what makes a popular game. Like some of the more popular games, you know, in the esports circle are sort of like, you know, Rocket League and Overwatch and obviously Fortnite too. But I mean, do you think that there's some sort of a magical formula? Is it really like the game popularity then the esports after, or because the mix of it when they first come out and they mention esports almost seems to sour people.
Does it? I could see where that could happen. The only people that I'm really like concerned about and feel sorry for are, it used to be, hey, if I make something really cool, like, well, I'll just throw out a name like Warsaw or something, then, you know, we can get a big enough community to kind of like self-perpetuate. Now, if you are an indie developer making like a cute little platformer, then you're in good hands. If you're an indie developer making a roguelike, then you're in good hands. If you're an indie developer and you want to make anything like a multiplayer shooter, you're screwed because nobody's going to play it. And, you know, as soon as somebody downloads it and sees that nobody's playing, then they're never going to open it up again. So making multiplayer games as a small developer has gotten much harder than it used to be.
Yeah, no doubt. I receive keys for different people to play games on my channel and stuff. And every now and then I'll get the write up on it, the copy, and it mentions, hey, you know, this is we're aiming for this to be the next big multiplayer esport game. And when I read that, I'm just like, yeah, exactly. I'm like, OK, dude, good luck.
There's so much inertia now required to make anything multiplayer work, which there's a little bit of irony in there because the entire model of a free-to-play multiplayer game worked because there's no barrier of entry, which means that people will always be on the servers, which means that, you know, you'll have that massive bodies that you need to keep the game going. There were financial reasons for the free-to-play model as well, but also it's incredibly conducive to, you know, just keeping a multiplayer community alive. And unless you have that kind of scale, unless you have that kind of inertia, if you're a smaller developer, multiplayer just isn't going to be a thing for you.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Speaking of newer games in esports, we do have a newer Quake game, Quake Champions. Have you had any experience doing commentary for that?
Oh, yeah. Over the past, was it like 3 years now? QuakeCon's been a thing. DreamHack's been a thing. Ran the Quake Open League last year. was incredibly proud of that project. It was a lot of fun kind of directing and producing that. And there was a little bit of commentary in there as well. Really cool things. And actually, I think, you know, some technical things aside, there's a lot to appreciate about Quake Champions. You know, a lot of people won't realize that it's essentially Generations Arena, given a spit shine, which is, you know, fantastic.
With Quake Champions, I agree. I don't think it's a bad game at all, quite honestly. I just don't know how, you know, the gaming public will say is actually reacting to it. I feel like when it first was released, people were somewhat more open to trying it out. And even now that it's free to play, it doesn't seem like it's got the audience that it needs to keep going.
Yeah, and part of that will be some of the perceived issues with the game, sure. But part of that is also just like the nature of the market, the nature of the fact that it's an older IP that, you know, this was a problem with Quake Live as well. Is like, even though it's awesome and it runs really well and it's easy to get up and going, so many players either have this preconceived notion of what Quake is and they're not interested, or they go, oh, well, this is Quake 3. I've played that, you know, I've seen it, been there, done that, don't need to do it again. I'm hoping that, you know, with the recent popularity of the new Doom franchise, that's going to turn around a little bit, but maybe mm-hmm. the timing wasn't right for Quake Champions to really take off in that regard.
Yeah, and there's just so much competition, and really, yeah. You know, they tried to take the original formula and just add one new aspect to it. And I don't know, I have no idea about the development of that game. So I don't know if that came later or if that was always from the beginning. Like, listen, we've got to put this hero mechanic in here and kind of, I don't want to say shoehorn, because I don't feel like it was shoehorned, but you know, that definitely turned off a lot of people. It's like, mm-hmm. wait, you have to learn, and there's a use button. You got different. What? I just want to run around and blow stuff up, right? So, but I gotta say, you know, to me, they get credit for trying. You know, they could have walked away from that franchise, which I feel like. And listen, I'm not part of the Quake Champions community, so I could be talking on my ass, but it just feels like they're stepping away, or they're slowing things down, or maybe they're reevaluating, or maybe it's a financial thing and they're just trying to make, you know, some hard decisions.
Yeah. It's part of a bigger company now, you know, since
yeah.
2009.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
And a lot of the old guard have left. And so when it comes to some of these IPs, you know, at a corporate scale like that, you need somebody to kind of, you know, forgive the pun, you need somebody to champion the concept. You need somebody to like defend the idea and the project. And mm-hmm. if nobody is really stepping up to that, then there's not a lot of incumbent reason to like just make that happen. The only thing that really makes me sad, and this applies to Champs, it applies to a lot of games, is that the quality of the game doesn't really matter that much. Like,
oh boy.
Like, sure, Champions has some issues. Every game has some issues. I've seen some really good games come down the pipe, but the actual quality of the game as it's presented is a smaller factor than marketing, than, you know, getting publication out there, getting your leagues up and going in an organized way. Like, we've already noted that Overwatch feels like it's like pushing a rock uphill, because I mean, it's an incredibly polished game for what it is. It is very tightly designed. I might not be the biggest fan of what that design is, but it accomplishes all of its goals in a very clean and polished way, and still Blizzard is having to put in a lot of work to make Owl you know, worthwhile and watchable.
Yeah, there is a lot of truth to that, because one of the other really huge games that came out just a few years ago, you know, PUBG, obviously yeah. when that was released, it was playable, but not in the best state, you know.
Yeah, and that didn't keep it from being like the biggest thing for a longer period than most games are.
Right.
And the only no reason doubt. I think PUBG stopped being as big as it was because, you know, other games came in that would be a little bit shinier, a little bit newer. And that's just the way the world goes.
Yep. Completely. Yeah, that was a very interesting time. I think we talked about it on the show with other guests as well. But yeah, that little window where PUBG was just killing it, and then Fortnite was like, all right, we're going to completely copy that. And then they just took it. You know, took the whole audience over. Was pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, and it always makes me laugh, because there will be people who will say like, oh, well, if this bug was fixed, then the game would be massively popular. I'm like, no.
Yeah,
there are huge games with lots and lots of bugs. So unfortunately, it's not quite as straightforward as make a good game and it'll be popular. I wish that was the world we lived in. That would make me feel a lot better about things, but it just isn't.
Yeah, I think the guys behind Apex would have something to say about that with Titanfall 2.
Yeah, and Apex itself, it really shames the rest of the industry because when it came out, it just worked. Sure, like there were like minor issues with lobbies, but compared to, you know, the rest of the market, it was relatively bug free. And the fact that it hasn't been coming out with content every, you know, like week has been something I think the larger market has been seeing as a negative, which is a little bit unfair, but that's how it be.
Yep. Dems the brakes.
Well, let's talk about QuakeCon just for a minute, because you're getting ready to get on a plane in a couple weeks here, right? A couple days.
Actually, I got on a plane 7 years ago now, and I haven't.
That's
left,
right.
So
that's right.
<You're>, so actually, now I'm a 20-minute drive.
Yeah, you hop down the freeway.
Yeah.
So tell us about that journey a little bit, because I do know I heard the story before in another outlet, but you know, definitely kind of fun things that you were kind of like thrown into the fire big time, out of the frying pan into the fire. So talk a little bit about that for people who might not have caught that.
Man, QuakeCon, yeah, it's changed a lot, but there are many ways in which it's very much the way it's always been. And if anybody hasn't been to QuakeCon, I would still highly recommend going there, because that's the place where you're going to meet, you know, other Quake mappers, other Doom players, you know, the whole crowd, and that's how things go. Like, so many things begin because you meet people at QuakeCon, and it's a wonderful thing. But yeah, I started going in 06. I just wanted to go. I had a clan member encourage me to go, still a really good friend, and yeah, I met like the rest of the Quake 2 community, and that's the point where it stops being, you know, just a bunch of people online, and it turns into people that you know and will know for the rest of your life. So that's always special, and that's always worth going to. And yeah, that turned into, oh geez, that turned into bringing a girlfriend to QuakeCon, which is always an incredibly risky thing, and I would never ever recommend it. But
I was gonna say, you're out of your mind, dude.
Yeah, but I got very lucky, and now Rotten Rose is she's more popular at QuakeCon than I am. So that was the other side of that sword. But no, yeah, we turned it into a thing where, yeah, I made a Quake 2 map that was multiplayer. It was a deathmatch map, but it also had a button in there that would pop the question, will you marry me, floating down from the sky with like the Quake 2 explosions going off. Very cheesy, very corny, but it was a lot of fun.
That's great.
No, that's awesome. I love that story. That's and it didn't go off well, if I recall correctly, right?
Yeah, the same guy who like brought me to QuakeCon the first time, he actually found the super secret button that I would push like 5 minutes into the game. He found it in like the first 10 seconds. So I like reach over and punch, you know, my now wife in the shoulder, going, "Look up." Because she would have missed it otherwise. Like, I don't think she had her headphones on, so the explosions weren't really registering.
That's hilarious. baby, look up. Baby,
yeah,
baby.
Look up in the sky. I mean, up there.
Yeah. It's so romantic. Look at it.
It was the least romantic thing ever, but how it is.
But hey, the story is worth all the, you know, kind of drudgery of, you know, making a map, you know, trying to time everything. And so for your second wife, maybe it'll go a little smoother.
No, I think I'm going to stick with the one for a while.
Okay, no, I think that's a great
idea. For a while.
That's a great idea.
It was enough work getting the one. I'm tired. and then with broadcasting, yeah, I mean, that all goes to the Quake Live TV crew. Grease Scotsman, Slava, Simek, Fish Sticks, MatCom. All those guys, yeah, they were very much in the same spirit of, hey, we came to QuakeCon with a few microphones and a PC and Flash Media Live encoders. So let's put on a fucking show. And yeah, I kind of fell in with them, and for no reason whatsoever, Grease Scotsman was like, hey, you get on the mic. We'll do this next game together. And I was like, oh, okay, sounds like fun. Sure. And you pretend you know what you're doing. And then and then 12 years later, you're still pretending to know what you're doing.
So, how
aren't we all, you know?
Well, yeah, it's very apparent on this show here.
Yes,
on this,
for sure.
On this end of the mic, anyway. But how, you know, listen, how do you go about becoming a commentator, a play-by-play commentator for something that is so fast? I mean, the fastest game that I can think of is maybe hockey, and that looks like it's running through molasses compared to a Quake Live or, you know, any of these first-person games. How do you even prepare for that?
I've never really conceptualized of it too much. Like, I haven't really broken it down. I think the most fair thing to say is that several sections of your brain just get turned off. You know, the sections of your brain that go, hey, should I say this? Or does the sentence even make any sense whatsoever? So some of that needs to just kind of go away. So that helps. And yeah, I mean, every year you could look at your like archival footage and go like, wow, I was shit back then. And probably, you know, 5-10 years from now, I'm going to say that about today. So that's it's something that will keep improving just the more you do it. But there are a lot of periods where, yeah, the speed is necessary, especially if, you know, somebody's doing like a quad run on DM2. But if you watch commentators like Tosspot, I know he's big corporate man now and doesn't do as much commentary, but in the heyday, he was like one of the like the best like Quake and Enemy Territory commentators, I thought. And one of the things he would do is that during those slow, quiet moments, he would get like a very hushed, quiet, suspenseful, and then get, you know, really loud when things like explode again.
Right.
So yeah, there's definitely a lot of call for like some dynamism and kind of tailoring it to what's going on in the game. But as far as like what you do during a match, I don't know if I've ever had any good advice. I know a lot of people like Red Eye, a lot of people like DJ Wheat have put a lot of time and effort into breaking down what it is they do and explaining it to other people, but I haven't been one of those people.
I mean, it helps that you know the game. I mean, it was really clear, you know, on the older match I was watching last night. It was like, oh, he's played these maps quite a few times, I'm assuming.
In some cases, yeah. Sometimes you just got to fake it and not be afraid to say the wrong thing. Maybe that's the best or worst advice, depending on how you look at it, is you're going to say stupid shit, and that has to be okay. You're going to be wrong 6 times out of 10, and that has to be okay. You have to be very comfortable with being wrong most of the time.
Yeah, and you also have to be comfortable with, like, you got to be comfortable with when that's captured and then it's on YouTube for everybody to see, and then everyone keeps commenting about how you were wrong for years and years. So,
oh, well, as like a general thing, if you're being called an idiot by people you don't know on the internet, you're doing the right thing.
Oh my god, it's such a zen way to think about it, because
if nobody is calling you stupid, then nobody's watching you.
True. That's true.
Good point.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Now, so how has social media kind of changed what?
Ugh.
Yeah, I know. I know.
Gives you shivers.
I know. I know. There's it's had an impact, because you know, you used to go onto a forum, log in, you know, create a username, and that's the community, and it's not just anybody popping in, and you know. So I know that has had to have changed what you do, and so, how has it changed it?
I would be happier pretending like nothing's changed, but yeah, you're right. It has to be admitted that the dynamics are a little bit different. I wouldn't say that things are fundamentally qualitatively different, but just the speed of things has increased so much. This is going to sound strange to anybody who knows what I'm talking about, but I kind of miss the ESR days. Of ES Reality, because yeah, it was a total cesspool. People were shitty to each other. People were just ruthless in how they would just tear you apart. Like, one of the scariest things about QuakeCon for years was the ESR thread is just going to be like the worst thing ever, and I'm going to want to kill myself after that. But I don't know. I think depending on who you are, you can respond to that kind of feedback in a very positive way, and I think I've tried to. Where, all right, cool. Now I know everything I've done wrong, and I'm going to try not to do that stuff ever again. And over the years, the ESR threads for QuakeCon have gotten better. And I think that's something that's missing now to a lot of people. And I don't think it's a social media thing so much as a generational gap between people who grew up just being yelled at on the internet all the time versus people who grew up not being yelled at on the internet all the time. I don't want to be, you know, like an old father figure and say like, oh, it builds character, but it kind of does. I don't know. When I have kids, I'll be like, all right, you're 12 years old. Time to get on 4chan.
Oh no. Oh God.
It'll make a man out of you.
Oh God. Yeah.
Or something.
Or something. Yeah. I don't know. It's difficult to predict which way that stuff will go, but yeah, I wish people wouldn't take everything so seriously all the time and personally. And I think, you know, forums like Doomworld and forums like ESR were a good way to kind of get out of that mindset where, yeah, you're going to get called the worst things on the planet, and that has to be okay.
It's okay with me.
You're okay with him being called the worst things in the planet?
Yeah, pretty much. No, okay. You can take it, obviously, and you know, it's, I mean, for as good as you are and what you do, even that you take the critiques and kind of still try to shape your, your next match. I mean, that's very commendable. So let me ask you about mappers, Mark, and this is, I don't want this to sound self-serving because by the time this airs, I will have already been on it. So we don't need to talk about me, but talk about that. Cause it just kind of, to me, it just popped out of nowhere and I'm like, oh, cool. Someone's doing mapping content, like real true blue mapping content. So talk about the genesis of that and where that's headed.
So part of this is because I am an old codgery sort, and back when Quake Live TV started, like if you were doing video gaming stream content, it had to be in service of like some event, like some competition, some tournament. And for a long time, that's all streaming was you're doing it for like some tournament somewhere. The technology was not accessible enough, and it was enough of a pain in the ass that just streaming yourself playing a video game was the stupidest thing you could ever want to do. And even then, at the time, we were called stupid for wanting to do streams of multiplayer stuff because, well, why don't you just watch it in QTV? There was a time where we had to convince people that streaming was a valuable thing to have for people who didn't have the game installed or had never played the game. But single player stuff was not even on the radar for such a long time. So yeah, I was doing video streaming before the advent of Let's Plays, and I never really got into Let's Plays. I think there's like a South Park episode or something about just not getting it, and I relate with that one a lot. And that kind of translated into me not really enjoying doing Let's Plays. So if I'm playing like a single player game, like either I just want to be immersed in that single player experience and not talk to other people, I sure as hell don't want to be like putting on a show. But I've always wanted to do more coverage of single player stuff. And the question was like, how do I do that without just hating it the whole time? Which again, just sounds like a shitty thing to say, but I don't like, you know, having that layer of fakeness when doing like a single player thing, like overreacting to things or, you know, not getting to take coffee breaks and just stare at a wall for 10 minutes because I'm interested in a texture. And one of the things that'll happen pretty often in this community, which is awesome, is that you'll be playing something and the guy who made the map will show up in chat. And that's like really cool. But then while you're streaming it, it's like, oh, hey, so-and-so's in chat. How you doing, dude? Your map's really cool. And it becomes like this awkward one-sided conversation. So, and it's another like scheduling thing too, right? So this is another like confession. If there's a show I want to do and it's just me streaming a game, it'll never happen because the time will come and I'll be like, I'll do it tomorrow or I'll do it next week or I'll just never do it. So Mapper's Mark solves a lot of those problems for me. For one thing, like I can have the actual author on there and, you know, have that two-way conversation. You've got real content because you've got real information coming from the guy who made it. And that's neat to me and hopefully neat to the audience. And the fact that I have to schedule it with another person means I can't just bail randomly. So it keeps me honest.
That's very
keeps me on schedule. So yeah, there's a lot of cynical reasons why I'm trying this thing out, but they're all positive in the end, I hope.
Yeah, I could totally relate to what you're talking about because I do happen to do those Let's Plays. And fortunately, I am not the PewDiePie guy who's going to scream in the mic just because they're, you know, what most of my I'd like to think most of my responses are pretty natural on screen. But I do have those experiences with the mappers pop in, and I've had everything from the mappers mad at me for not understanding what they were going for with their map to they absolutely loved that I had a bad time with their map to I actually have had mappers where I said, this map is great. I love it. And they still were not happy enough with my response to it. So it's been a wild roller coaster ride. I can totally relate to that. But on the other note, though, when the mapper's in the chat, a lot of times the other people who are watching will chat with them too. So it kind of does add this little conversation piece to it, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, because it's the cool thing about single player mapping between Doom and Quake. It's not just the fact of the product itself. It's the fact that everybody is providing feedback to each other. It is a real community. You will have little art movements that happen within a community where, you know, for like a year, because some mapper did something, this, you know, this little technique will be popular for a while until somebody else does something else. Like, I don't know if you've played Sigil by John Romero yet, but he uses one decorative object as a shootable switch a lot as like, you know, how he builds out his maps. And now every time I see that object in new maps, I'd shoot it just in case somebody's like putting in a secret or using that as a method. And I think I've seen some people doing that already. So you have like these really fine grain and really trackable like trends that go through mapping. You have like techniques getting shared between people. You've get mods like, you know, Arcane Dimensions coming out, and then, you know, for the next few years, like everybody's about breaking wood planks, and that's awesome. And I love just how I don't want to use the word zeitgeisty, but on a much, you know, smaller scale, how fluid a lot of these ideas are between them.
Yeah, definitely. And it's good for sampling too, because I watched the Zazer, you know, stream last night, and I'm not very familiar with Doom World. I love Doom, and I play Doom 2 and Doom, you know, and I'll every so often I'll fire it up just like I did with Quake for years. Every 2-3 years I'd fire it back up and see what's going on in the community. But then, you know, seeing his work, and just, it just makes me want to play and just jump in. So it's great for sampling and getting the word out and all that stuff too. So I love how you have the time to create system. So talk about that a little bit.
The time to create stuff. Oh yeah. So, yeah, this is another thing where like the generational gap will play into it, because anybody who wasn't around or hasn't looked at the archives of old man Murray will have no idea what's going on. But they had this great article or series of articles back in the day where the method of determining how good a game was how soon you run into a crate. And, you know, that could apply to like barrels as well as it did in Doom. But the fascinating thing about that is that they went from like Doom all the way up to like Deus Ex. And that's when the site kind of like stopped being a thing. But crates are just so ubiquitous, not only in Doom and Quake maps, but in every game ever.
Yeah, pretty
like
much.
I could load up, you know, like 6 random things out of my Steam library and run a start to crate timer, and it would probably get triggered within 10 minutes every time. Crates are just everywhere, and they will be with us forever. So yeah, it's a little bit of just like an in-joke, but it's also like a fun, like, hey, you know, at what point did you, you know, bend your will and or have your will broken and just put a crate there? You know, I just need, yeah. I need a box.
You're gonna start a whole new trend now where you're gonna see nothing but crate levels, but that's already been done. But
oh yeah, it absolutely has. Yeah.
But Metal Gear Solid brought the cardboard box into the whole. You know, that's a whole nother.
That's definitely a crate.
Yeah, exactly. That's awesome.
So I want to know, Jahar, from your perspective, if people want to get into checking out some of your commentary and work or whatever, what would you suggest they jump into?
I've been notoriously bad at archiving things over the years. Fortunately, there are crazy people on YouTube who, you know, pirate and archive everything, which, you know, God bless them, because without them, a lot of stuff probably wouldn't be around anymore. I don't know. It depends on what you like. I've had phases where I'm doing more of one thing than another for a while. For the past few years, it's been a lot of Quake Champions. I've been doing a lot more Quake World, though. And Quake World is just a very exciting competitive community. And QH Land is coming up at the end of August. I'm planning on being there and producing that show. So really looking forward to that. Actually, QH Land 2017 is probably one of the most dense pieces of content that you could watch. Because over the course of 3 days, there were 4 or 5 tournaments that BPS put together. And I'm calling him out by name because he's the evil mastermind who put it all together and made it so that nobody was sleeping more than like 2 or 3 hours each night, myself included. And it was just game after game after game after game. And if you were playing in any of those tournaments, it was just like constantly, okay, as soon as you finish this duel, you need to get into this 4v4. As soon as you're done with that 4v4, you need to get into this 2v2. And it was just brutal. But, you know, when you're doing a LAN party, that's what you want. You want everybody to be just this withered husk by the end of the event. So that's what we're aiming for this year. We certainly accomplished that in 2017. So yeah, I think that's pretty fun TV. There's a lot of things though that just kind of like blur together and things I would never ever watch again. One of them was actually the Quake World Finals at QuakeCon 2016, I believe. Where during the finals it was 4v4, but we didn't have monitor on our headsets, so we couldn't like hear ourselves, and more importantly, I couldn't hear the co-commentator DDK. And all we could hear was like our voices bouncing off the back wall. And I actually had to like look at his lips and be like, okay, whatever he's saying, when his lips stop moving, I better start saying something. And oh, that is one video I will probably never go back and watch. And I hope nobody ever does either. I don't know why I'm talking about it now.
I wonder if Al Michaels ever had to deal with that.
It was awful. And there were some issues with the audio mixing, where like the DJ would just start playing music randomly in the middle of a match. I think the issue was he was still being piped out to house, but he didn't know that. So he thought he was just playing the music for himself in his headphones so he could prepare for the next segment. But he was like blasting the house. Nobody could hear anything. And he was just like nodding away on his headset. Like, oh, yeah, the bass sounds good right now. I don't know why. until somebody like slapped him in the face and had him stop. But yeah, that was a train wreck. And the most tragic part of that, it was right before like the most epic Quake Live match in Quake Live history. That was Rafa and Evil with like a game on Elder that went to like what, 6 or 7 overtimes. So yeah, we had like one of the best matches that day ever. And it was preceded by like just this train wreck of a Quake World commentary. So yeah, go watch that one. I never will.
Hey, I love that. I asked, which one should people watch? You're like, don't watch this one.
that link's going in the show notes. Nah. We don't want to make you look bad.
Oh, no. I, again, like I said before, like that's not a concern of mine. I've had a lot of practice looking bad and being okay with that.
I think that's a perfect line to end the show. We could all relate.
Well, listen, is there anything else we want to talk about? What did we miss? I'm sure we missed a million things.
It's such a dense community, including some of the people in it. And there's always a lot to go into.
Oh, I'm very dense.
But yeah, I mean, people will keep playing Quake. People will keep playing Doom. The fact that, you know, streaming and Trench Broom and the latest releases of Doom Builder have, you know, created a bit of a resurgence in activity. I think you've noticed it more in the Quake community than it's been noticed in Doom. But, you know, that's all very positive. It brings people in. It keeps things going. And shit, maybe I want to get back into mapping as well.
Yeah, I think you should. You definitely should. This is the time. And I got to say, with Quake 2 RTX coming out, just people just seeing it in the, you know, not that you would want to kind of target that, but just people seeing it and being reminded of Quake 2. I'm already seeing a bunch of movement in that area where some Quake 1 mappers are jumping to Quake 2. And I'll be doing some kind of tutorial. I don't know if it's going to be this big long thing, but just give people kind of a foray into using Trench Broom, because I had to go back to it. I'm like, God, I haven't made a Quake 2 map in over 20 years, or however long it's been, about 20 years actually. So, and I did go back and find that map, and it was like literally the worst thing ever. And I would never,
we should play on that.
We're not doing that.
Load it up.
No, it's the worst thing a map could be. It's very boring. It was just a shoebox level. And it was like, it was basically a box map that I kept working on and kept working on, and then just had some friends play, and then we never touched it again, thankfully. But that
it's
was
still worth bringing that up, though. You know, I think there's a lot of value in kind of looking at the past of your own work that way.
Oh, absolutely.
There's a Quake 2 mapper who's not mapping anymore, Merrick, but he was very prolific at the time. He numbered all of his maps, and you can play maps Merrick 1 through Merrick 127.
Oh my God, wow. That's crazy.
And all multiplayer maps. And what I love about that is that, yeah, he started with like shoebox maps, and then you can see like the precise moment he learned how to do a new thing, and he did that thing for a few more maps until he learned how to do a new thing, and then he did that thing for a few more maps. And, you know, you get like 50 maps into it, and you've seen a lot of growth and a lot of evolution. And, you know, not everybody puts out that much content, but I love watching that progression.
Yep, I've talked about that a few times where I get one mapper, and a lot of these guys, because Quake is having a little bit of a single player resurgence lately, I'll see players start, you know, with their first map, and then like by 2-3 years later, I see their, you know, fifth, sixth map, and it's like worlds away, and you get to see just how much they've grown. It's so cool.
Yeah, that's really special. And I think a lot of people see that as special as well, and it's something very unique to these kinds of communities, and I don't think it's going to stop anytime soon.
This is RC. Thanks for listening to the Quakecast. You can find me on YouTube at youtube.com/watchGGRC.
And I'm Dumptruck. You can find me on YouTube. Just search for Dumptruck_DS.
Before we sign off, I just want to remind people about The Mother Load and his In the Keep podcast. It's all about retro FPS and arena shooters. Go check out the podcast at inthekeep.com.
He went to, you know, he packed up his little, pack and went to QuakeCon and became a QuakeCon celebrity and commentator. And I'm going to start that over, RC. I was gonna make a really old reference, and I'm like, as I'm getting ready to say it, I was like, no one's gonna know what the fuck I am talking about.
The hobo,
I was
sack?
Gonna say, yeah, he was gonna have his handkerchief and put it on a stick and walk the Quake. Okay, let me pick that up.